House Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance will come to order. Committee Legislative Assistant, will you call the roll?
Chairman Smith?
Here.
Vice Chair Szymanski?
Here.
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Anderson?
Here.
Representative Champion?
Here.
Representative Cornish? Representative Gruenhagen?
Here.
Representative Hillstrom?
Here.
Representative Kreisel?
Here.
Representative Lane is excused. Representative Lesh? Representative Liebling? Representative Mazerol?
Here.
Representative Maylene?
Here.
Representative Schumacher?
Here.
Representative Vogel?
Here.
Representative Wardlow?
Here.
All right, there being present a quorum, we will proceed without final action. We will proceed with consideration of the minutes. February 24, 2011, they're in the packet. May I have a motion to approve? Representative Vogel moves approval of the minutes of February 24, 2011. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Minutes of February 24 are approved. Committee, just a reminder that on our agenda today we have no bills, but we do have two budget overviews. First, the Guardian Ad Litem Board, and secondly, the Public Defense Board. The responses that the committee has received in writing from these agencies are included in your folder. So with that, I'll call Susan Allegro to present on behalf of the Guardian Ad Litem Board. Morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Suzanne Allegro, the Program Administrator for the Guardian Ad Litem Board. As you may recall, last year's there was legislation to move the Guardian Ad Litem Program, which had been under the court system, and move it out of the court system and place it under an independent board. This was due to issues with appearance of conflict of interest or conflict of interest with having the court supervise a program where the employees were or the contractors were bringing issues before the court. Legislation was sought and was granted, and effective July 1st of 2010, the program was moved out of the judicial system and the board was appointed. As part of the legislation, the annual appropriation of $12.3 million, which had been the cost of running the program under the court system, was transferred over to the state board. Also effective July 1st, prior to July 1st, all of the different 10 district programs had a combination of in the first, second, and fourth, they do use volunteers, but and then all the other districts, including the first, second, and fourth, had a combination of employees and independent contractors. There were also some issues with continuing to use independent contractors, so the decision was also made to move to convert independent contractors into employees. They were not converted. A number of them were not converted as full-time. They were converted as portions of an FTE, depending on the need in each judicial district. There were no new costs associated with that conversion, but you will notice on some of the historical information, that's the explanation for why the FTEs increased from 1 year, from 2010 to this year. We do, in addition, I had mentioned that the first, second, and fourth rely on volunteers. Also, we do have a number of other volunteers, such as pro bono attorneys in the individual judicial districts. For example, Fagri and Benson provides pro bono work in Hennepin County if the guardian needs attorney representation. Additionally, statewide, the law firm of Robbins Kaplan provides pro bono help. The program does operate under a federal mandate And that was recently renewed by Congress in a bipartisan effort. And there's also state and county mandates for representation, for appointment of a guardian ad litem in juvenile and family court. Over the last 15 years, the program has undergone numerous changes, but one of the major changes is we are able now to provide 100% coverage on the mandated cases, and we certainly would like to keep up with that. Also, over the last few years, the program has developed standards for recruitment, selection, training, and complaint processing. And the program currently serves over 15,000 children in over 12,000 cases.
Is that it? All right.
Unless you would like me to go through the, just stand for questions or go through the material I submitted.
Why don't we, shift to questions at this point. I may ask you to go back, be a little more explicit on one or two points. Ms. Allegro, when the guardian ad litem program was carved out from the district courts to create a standalone board, were there any cost-sharing mechanisms that were lost or sacrificed?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think it's a little too early to say. I think there were at this point, obviously when we were under the court system, there were some sort of efficiencies in using the court system personnel, and we hope to contract for those services at a nominal or no cost. I think the thing that the unknown in is now moving from district-based programs to a statewide program. We're not sort of bound by district boundaries, and maybe we could use the personnel a little more efficiently. That's something we are working on. And also, again, if they're district-based, I think the board's intent is that hopefully there would be ability to share resources such as some attorney representation, training opportunities, that type of thing.
Ms. Allegro, you suggested or testified that you are at 100% coverage of federally mandated cases. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, federally mandated plus the 100% coverage in the state mandated family cases as well.
Can you discuss the difference between the differences that may exist in the services provided through federal mandate versus state mandate?
When the federal mandate went into effect in 1974, the following year, the state also did mandate for appointment of a guardian ad litem and did further define in statute the duties of a guardian ad litem. And in some instances, I think the state mirrored what the federal government had required and additionally perhaps went a little beyond that. In addition, I think over the years, the court system has really had a firm commitment to ensuring that guardian ad litems are appointed in all these cases and that they do perform the duties of the position, both the mandated duties of the position.
Ms. Allegro, on looking at your written material submitted, you reference permissive appointment in family court when the bench is in need of custody and or parenting time recommendation. You also suggest, or it's here in writing, that the lack of a guardian ad litem in such cases would result in prolonged conflicts in families where custody, etc. disputes exist. That sounds to me like a permissive appointment just to move a case along at a little more rapid pace than the court would like. Can you tell me in this committee a rough percentage of the cases that fall under mandated services versus permissive?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a little difficult in that sometimes the judges may sort of have difference of opinion as far as permissive versus mandated, but a rough percentage would be 70% mandated and 30% permissive.
Now, is that 70% of the cases or 70% of the actual time involved in full?
Mr. Chair, that's 70% of the cases.
That are mandated?
Yes, sir.
And 30% are permissive?
Yes, sir.
Do the permissive cases take longer, less, or the same amount of time as a mandated case?
Mr. Chair, I'd say it really just depends on the cases. Typically, they might be a little longer in just that I think the judges need resources, somebody to help them decide custody or parenting time issues. So just depending on how complicated that might be. The other thing I might mention is those type of cases are ones we do seek reimbursement for the guardian's time, and it tends to be more in the permissive family court cases.
Reimbursement from where?
From the parties, Mr. Chair.
What's your success ratio in achieving reimbursement?
Mr. Chair, obviously we don't seek them on, you know, if the parties are in form of paupers or they don't have the ability to pay, but I think the success is fairly good in those districts where they have a sort of a very good collection program and they're on top of it. That's one of the things that we're going to look at is expanding the use of screener collector in those districts that now are not perhaps as successful at due to lack of resources. I think we're going to look at more of a central collection, screener collection process. That's something we're moving forward on.
Ms. Allegro, on those cases that are required by federal mandate, are there federal funds to pay for those or to help pay for those cases?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do receive, the state does receive federal funds. It goes to the Department of Human Services. When I checked with them, they said it was around $370,000 a year, so it's not, given the nature of the mandates, it's not a huge amount of money.
Are there any other federal grants that you're aware of that might be available?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not aware right now, but we certainly are looking.
Ms. Leger, I want to get back to the permissive appointment. I think I'm hearing you're suggesting some kind of harm if guardian ad litems were less available in cases involving pro se litigants or under the permissive appointment approach. What's your opinion, if you have one? What's the reason for some or maybe all of these permissive appointments? Is it to save the court's time or serve the best interests of the child?
Mr. Chair, I can give you some examples of when a judge does appoint a guardian in those type cases, and that would be custody and parenting time issues that had not been resolved in other ways, that the party's gone through mediation, early neutral evaluation, previous pretrial hearings, affidavits or accounts from the parties that had significant discrepancies when addressing matters pertaining to children. Parties did not have an attorney to help resolve or settle some of the disputes. There was a significant trigger, such as a disabled child, chemically dependent, or autistic child. One of the parties did not appear or was incompetent due to mental health or chemical dependency issues. Post-decree issues, for example, the kids were older and no longer wanted or were cooperative with the parenting plan. One other thing I would mention, certainly the judges are doing it, I think, to in the best interest of the child. I think the one thing when we talk about it does result in fewer hearings, while that might be a court savings, that's also certainly better for the families that they're not in these protracted long hearings and that type of thing. I think that in addition to court time, there also is a benefit not for the parties not to be involved in a dispute any longer than they have to.
Returning to reimbursement, the statute does allow the guardian ad litem fees to be paid by the parties. Can you tell me, you had the amount of federal funds available for the federal mandated cases, $370,000. So do you have a number of the amount of money that is actually reimbursed, number one, by the parties? And number two, what portion of the time and money spent on the case does that reimbursement represent?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we collect annually, it's about $500,000 to $600,000 a year on reimbursements. I think it does, on those cases where we do collect the reimbursement, it does cover the guardian ad litem's time. Obviously, as I mentioned before, if the parties are cannot pay, we obviously can't collect on those cases.
Ms. Allegra, your board reflects that it has three leased vehicles and an overall in-state travel budget of $950,000. First of all, who uses the three vehicles and for what purpose?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the vehicles are used by the guardian ad litems when they need to go out and do home visits. They need to visit with the parents. They need to perhaps visit the foster home. So basically, it's in the course of carrying out their investigation and the people that they need to interview. What we are looking at a number of things in the mileage area. Some of the districts are looking at their number of the employees that are in the home office, and we're looking at if it was cheaper to move from the home office to a leased office and save on mileage there. The other thing with the lease vehicles or the vehicles that we have looked, and in some instances it's cheaper to use the vehicle than to pay mileage.
So on the leased vehicle, you're not accruing mileage or paying it? Can you break down the $950,000 line item? What of that amount goes as actual rent on the car leases, and what therefore would be paid as other costs of that $950,000?
Mr. Chair, I don't have that breakdown right now.
You can get it to us.
Yes, sir.
Three closing questions. In your material you have provided to the committee, you've recapped some guardian ad litem services for a refugee youth. In that particular case or cases, is there any additional or special federal revenue that is set aside or paid to you to cover those costs on refugees?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not aware of any.
Are you aware of any functions that the board performs that are not required by statute?
Mr. Chair, our state guardian ad litem board?
Yes.
At this point, we're relatively new, but they are performing all the duties that are mandated by statute.
Any other questions? Okay, we have Representative Anderson and Liebling. Representative Anderson, go ahead.
I have a few questions. How do you determine how they are paid and how many, like, is it 50% of them are paid or, like, statewide, how many of them are paid and how do you determine how much they get for a salary?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not.
You said some of them are volunteers, so those are not getting paid, and then some people do get a salary, don't they?
Ms.
Yes.
Electro.
I'm sorry. Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative. Traditionally, the programs in the 2nd and 4th District have relied on volunteers to perform the work of the guardian ad litem. So, in essence, those programs are volunteer-based. The other eight districts, I think for reasons it may be more difficult to set up a volunteer program in outstate Minnesota, they have tended to rely more on employees.
Representative Anderson, anything further?
So to the testifier, how are they paid then? How do you determine their salary? And is it the state funds, federal funds?
Mr. Chair, Representative, they are state employees, and they're paid according to a pay scale that the Supreme Court or the State Court Administration, when they were part of State Court Administration, they were evaluated and placed on the pay scale, and they still have that same pay scale when they moved over to us.
I have another question.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, to the testifier, what about their training now? Is that standardized for everybody has to go through the same training, or is it different per different judicial district?
Ms. Allegro.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is standardized, and everybody, there's certain pre-service requirements that every, whether it's a volunteer or a paid employee, needs to go through. Additionally, if and we don't tend to do this typically with the volunteers, but with the employees, if they are going to work in family court, for example, there is specialized training that they would need to go through in family court. Additionally, we have components for domestic violence and also the Indian Child Welfare Act. We do training in that as well.
Representative Anderson.
So who oversees the guardian ad litems?
Ms. Allegro.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in each of the judicial districts, there is a program manager that is the supervisor of the individual guardian ad litems and the volunteers in that particular district. And then, in turn, the managers report to me now as the program administrator.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Representative
Chairman.
Anderson.
Thank you.
All right. I was in error. We've got Representative Johnson, Shemanskin, and Liebling next. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Allegro, I was looking at your writings here. You say that a base budget reduction would greatly restrict the type of case in which a guardian ad litem could be appointed. Could you say a little bit more about what kind of cases would be restricted and to what extent you would be further away from reaching the mandated cases that you're required to serve?
Ms. Allegro.
With the reduction?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, I think obviously if we had a budget reduction, we would not be able to, if we're at 100% on our mandated cases now, we most likely would not be able to continue on the mandated cases. I think it would be up to the board then to determine which case types would not get a guardian. I mean, the judges may still order up, but we may not be able to provide it. As I pointed out, on the permissive cases, obviously those would be ones that we maybe could not provide a guardian, but also we do get reimbursement on those, and we're looking to, through different ways, increase that reimbursement.
Mr. Chair, to that point.
Representative Hillstrom on that point.
Thank you. To follow up to that, so if a judge appoints and the guardian ad litem can't do it, what happens?
Ms. Allegro.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there would be no guardian ad litem on that particular case. We did have years ago, when we were not at the same funding level, we did have situations where they just did not have guardian ad litems on these cases.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure that you know that there's, maybe you know that there is a proposal moving through the legislature here to change the presumption of parenting in family cases to a presumption of joint custody away from the standard of best interests of the child. And as we know, when we change something in the system, it impacts other things in the system. It's I think somebody referred to the judicial system, or maybe they were talking about education or something else, but it's a kind of ecology, isn't it, that where everything really interacts. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts, and if you don't, if you haven't examined that legislation, that's fine. But I'm just wondering, since we're talking about the need for guardians ad litem and how important they are in protecting children's interests in these cases, if we were to move from away from the best interests of the child standard, would that increase the burden on your office or impact your budget in any way?
Ms. Allegro.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we really haven't studied the legislation, but I think the role of the guardian is to protect the best interests of the child, so it would get obviously to the heart of what the guardian is mandated to do. So I don't, it's a little difficult to answer.
Any other questions? All right, thank you for your cooperation, your information. Uh, I'd like to call now William Kyer and I believe William Ward to discuss the Public Defense Board.
Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defense. With me today is William Ward. Mr. Ward is the Chief Public Defender in the 4th Judicial District. Mr. Chairman, about 2 weeks ago we were here and gave a background on the board. There's a little bit of that in your handout that you have in your packet. I don't intend to go through that. I don't intend to go through all of that, but I will reference some of the slides that you have. Mr. Chairman, the board, as a quick reminder to folks, provides constitutionally and statutorily mandated services on the trial and the appellate level. Public defenders cannot refuse cases, and their workload really is controlled by outside factors, and we talked a little bit about that a couple of weeks ago. The annual budget for this year is just over $67 million. About $2.5 million of that is in special revenue and federal funding, both of which will end June 30th or are scheduled to end June 30th. About $1.9 million of that $2.5 is from an attorney registration fee that was approved by the Supreme Court, with the additional $500,000 or $600,000 in one-time federal funding through the federal stimulus funding. Mr. Chairman, as you all know, we visited with you and a number of you. The board continues to face significant financial challenges. In its February 2010 report on the public defender system, the Office of the Legislative Auditor stated that public defender cases are too high, resulting in public defenders spending limited time with clients, difficulties preparing cases, and scheduling problems that hinder the efficient operation of the criminal courts. Since 2008, we have lost 63 attorney positions, or roughly 15% of our staff, about 120,000 hours of attorney time. Caseloads for public defenders are just shy of double the ABA and our own board caseload standards. On an annual basis, our part-time defenders provide about 40,000 hours of unpaid time. Simply put, Mr. Chairman, we don't have enough bodies to be everywhere we need to be and to prepare the cases that need to be prepared. In your handout on pages, I believe it's 11 and 12, you'll see a couple of maps. We have about half the counties in Minnesota where we are not available for first appearance, either for in-custody or out-of-custody cases. Again, it's just a matter of not having enough bodies. For you lawyers in the room, imagine this. Imagine that you have a client, you agree to take their case, but you tell them you only have about 10 minutes to meet them, evaluate the case, explain the consequences of the various options, get a decision from them on how to proceed. And by the way, if your case is in one of the wrong counties, I'm not going to be there for your first court appearance. It doesn't inspire a lot of confidence either in you or in the criminal justice system. What are we talking about in terms of impacts? On pages 15 through 19 in that handout, again, some of the impacts that we have seen. Again, the Office of the Legislative Auditor indicating the high public defender caseloads are dragging down the justice system. Courtrooms sitting idle. In its 2010 July report, the National Conference of State Courts, in a judicial workload assessment, said judges are forced to wait when public defenders are in other courtrooms, and public defenders are forced to ask for continuances due to high caseloads. And just to give you a few of these examples, I was in the 10th District not long ago over in Sherburne County. Between 9 o'clock and noon that day, the court stopped four different times because the public defender had to be down the hall in a separate courtroom. In the 7th Judicial District, a while back, we had a public defender who was conducting a jury trial. They were slipped a note asking them to come down the hall when there was a break in the jury trial because the judge down the hall was handling the juvenile calendar, and they wanted them to come down and handle the juvenile calendar when they got a break in the jury trial. I'm sure you've read at some point of some of the contempt cases, judges holding public defenders in contempt basically because they're not in their courtroom, but they're in a courtroom in another county. I bring that up not so much as an indictment of the judges, but just a frustration, I think, that all of us are feeling right now of not having enough resources in the criminal justice system. It is not unusual for public defenders, again, to have three or four felony trials scheduled in one day. In the 9th District in our Grand Rapids office, we have a managing attorney in our Grand Rapids office who has to travel to International Falls. That's about 119 miles one way. He leaves on Sunday. He handles the Monday adult calendar, stays overnight Monday, handles the juvenile calendar on Tuesday morning, and then comes back to Grand Rapids on Tuesday. And he's also supposed to be supervising the attorneys in that area. In Olmsted County, I know that we've talked to a number of you, we have trials that are now set out 14 months. I was in the 3rd Judicial District last month meeting with a number of lawyers. We have one new attorney who told me that she has had 1 week since July of last year where she has not had a felony trial scheduled, and that was the week that she was on vacation. We had another woman who told me she's been with us since 2009. She started doing felony work almost immediately. One of the first days she came into court, she was told by the judge that she was going to have a felony trial that day. She hadn't met the client. She hadn't reviewed the discovery. She was finally given time over the noon hour to meet with the client and to review the discovery with him. Right now, our folks are averaging about 400 open files a year, 400 cases. I think if you talk to some busy criminal lawyers, and I know there are a couple of you in the room, if you're opening 70 or 75 cases a year, you're a busy criminal attorney. On the appellate level, Mr. Chairman, I think as you've heard from the courts, we are just flat out not meeting the timelines that the appellate court and the Supreme Court have. We just can't do it. Some of the other issues that we've been dealing with, we have seen an increase in ethics complaints against our lawyers. We have had a number of folks who have health-related issues, folks in their 30s and 40s having high blood pressure issues, you name it, we've had it. Grievances. We have a grievance right now filed for over caseloads, excessive caseloads done in the 3rd District. And turnover of experienced lawyers. This is one where we've really seen in the last few years where we've had our lawyers who are with us 5, 6, 7 years, the folks who are now finally know what they're really doing, can make those transitions, can review cases, find out which ones really need investigation, find out which ones really need to work. They are now moving on to other things, particularly over to the county attorneys or to the prosecutors. And sometimes for more money, sometimes for the same amount of money, but always for fewer cases and fewer caseloads. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Ward to talk about some specifics and then maybe get into the governor's budget and the budget request and kind of where we're at with that.
Very good. Go ahead.
Thank you. Chair, my name is Bill Ward. I'm the Chief Public Defender of the 4th Judicial District. You know, the reality is this, is that one of the reasons I came to the state over 10 years ago was because of the public defender system that's in place here. And unfortunately, for my decade here, I'm watching what is and has been a great system erode into something that we should not be proud of. I mean, there are things to be proud of. The statewide system is something that we can look at as far as you could be in Grand Rapids or in Hennepin County, and you have the same, let's say, infrastructure in place, the same technology that can be used by the lawyers across the 87 counties in the state. You have good training programs that you can do in-house for much, much less money than sending people out of state. So we do have those things. But I never thought I'd talk to you about instances that Mr. Kier referenced where we are not at the first appearance in over 50% of the counties in the state. Your son or daughter or cousin is arrested, they're brought to court, and we don't have a lawyer there to represent them for the bail hearing. The judge, she or he, has to make a determination based upon questioning the client as to what the bail should be for these folks. That's unconscionable. And the reason is because we don't have the bodies to send to the various courthouses in order to staff the bail hearings that are held every single day in the state. On folks who are out of custody, Representative Lesh, I'm sure you've come across this, where we've got cases where clients come in at the first appearance out of custody, and there are counties where we don't have lawyers represent them. When I was the chief of the 10th district in four of the counties, we were not at the first appearance of out-of-custody cases, where we could use that time to resolve cases, to get them out of the system. Instead, they're continued to have a chance to talk to their lawyers. They can review the discovery and review what needs to happen on these cases. Those things are something we should not be proud of. We should be saddened by the fact that we are ill-equipped to handle the amount of cases that are being assigned to our lawyers. When Mr. Kyer references the loss of lawyers, we've lost over 25 in the past few years in the 4th District. That obviously unduly burdens the system. And when you lose these good people, we're contracting out to try and make ends meet, and we're not making it. And at some point, when we bring people back into the system, I have to retrain lawyers to understand how to work in a relatively fast triage-type system. Right now, if I have a lawyer, and I've been doing this 25 years, if I see a case come across my desk, I can look at it, I can divulge the information, and within an hour or so, have an understanding as to where I should go as far as how this case should be handled. You bring a new lawyer into the system, it's going to take them triple or quadruple that time. That's an inefficient use of our time. And as we take these folks, spend the time and resources and energy to train them just to have them leave for something better because they can't handle the stress, that's something we should be ashamed of, and certainly I am in my office. I'm ashamed of the fact that I've got people who can't make ends meet, let alone on the emotional level, handle the amount of cases that they have to cover. I'm ashamed of the fact that we have folks who are setting 4, 5, 6, 8 cases for trial. Places like Pine County and the outstate counties, you have 60 cases on the trial calendar for 3 public defenders. 60 cases set for trial. Now, all of us know only one case can go to trial. We're talking about 60 cases that have to be resolved in that day or that calendar week. These are clients and family members have to wait and figure out and watch this McDonald justice being administered because we don't have the bodies to handle these cases when we should. The issue becomes also these cases are much more difficult than they were when I started in 1986. We have clients who have mental health issues that have not been addressed for decades. We have cases where the ramifications are much worse than they ever were before, everything from registration to lifetime imprisonment. And the mental health issues in dealing with these clients is exceedingly difficult and challenging. It's the practical administration of what we do that has become a challenge and a drain for everybody, all of the staff in our offices. And we're handling, their standards, the American Bar Association. Yeah, that's not our state, right? But these are folks who are a lot smarter than me, and they say, you should have at the most 400 case units a year. And we're at 800 or more per year. You know the system is failing the folks that we're supposed to serve. I don't have a choice as to which cases I get. We work hard with the judges to make sure that they screen the cases. I think certainly in most districts they do a very, very good job. We're getting the cases we're supposed to have. And they just keep growing and growing because we have less and less folks to handle them. Thank you.
Ms. Kyer, any?
Mr. Chairman and members, we do have a budget request there. It is a lot of money. It starts on page 28 of your handout. We understand the issues that the state is facing, that you are facing fiscally. Understand that we have an obligation also to bring forward to you the issues that we all are facing. And that's why we're here, and that's why this budget request is here. It is actually a series of 3 budget requests. The first one is a viability request, made up of 3 parts. One is to make up for the loss of one-time funding. Secondly, to fund attorney positions lost since 2008. And third, to fund the projected personnel cost increases for the next biennium, all of which obviously impact the number of people we can actually put in the courtrooms. Secondly is a request for mandated costs. That's on page 29 of your handout. This one consists of appellate office transcripts, and those of you who have been around here any length of time know what an issue this has been over the years. That budget is exceeded every year. We come back for deficiency requests. We basically rob Peter to pay Paul when we can. The budget's about $300,000 for transcripts in a given year. We typically spend over $600,000, $650,000 a year. Expert witness fees, again, as Mr. Ward indicated, cases are becoming much more complicated than in the past. If you think about where we were even 10 years ago, 15 years ago, computer forensics, DNA, ballistics, all of those things that now you know, lawyers have to be up on, that we have to have that information on, that we have to be able to study on those cases, which frankly we just can't do. Lastly, in that request is a request for help on immigration issues. And a recent Supreme Court decision, U.S. Supreme Court decision, Padilla, made lawyers responsible for informing their clients of the immigration consequences of their conviction or their plea. I want to be clear, this is not an issue of immigration. This is an issue of the responsibility of our lawyers and what they not only ethically are responsible for, but ultimately whether or not those cases end up getting kicked back to for retrial or for further review because somebody was found to be not competent. Lastly, Mr. Chairman, on the budget requests, as you all know, we have four public defense corporations that provide services, and we're asking for a small increase to keep those public defense corporations viable. They provide service in about 4,000 cases a year that, but for the corporations, those cases would be public defender cases. In terms of the impacts, Mr. Chairman, you know, we've talked about them. We've talked about those today. We've talked about them with you individually. We are at the breaking point, if not beyond that breaking point. I would refer you to page 38 of your handout. This was a quote from then-Governor Pawlenty in 2004, when, frankly, things were a lot better than they are today. Cutting staff would result in a dramatic reduction in the services provided to indigent defendants. Those layoffs could result in demands for speedy trials not being met, inappropriate release of accused criminals. Moreover, the quality of services you provide would be greatly impaired. We like to think of the court system, I think Representative Liebling brought it up, as an ecosystem. I want to read you one thing, and it's somewhat lengthy, and I don't normally like to do that because I know people tend to lose focus a little bit, but I got this email from one of our chief public defenders, and it kind of brings out the issue of the ecosystem. Here's a run-of-the-mill case. Client had accrued some not very serious juvenile adjudications, got charged with four very serious felony cases spanning 3 weeks as a young adult. The guideline sentence was for 10 years, and it was permissible for a judge to sentence him to 20. By devoting the public defender resources to identifying what triggered this, what treatment interventions were needed, what barriers existed to rehabilitation, and creating a non-prison plan for success, we were able to persuade the victims, the prosecutor, and ultimately the judge that a lengthy local jail sentence, followed by long-term treatment, was the appropriate sentence. This client thrived, was recommended for early discharge, and became a taxpaying citizen. About $2,000 worth of public defender resources spent saved taxpayers a minimum of $400,000 of DOC prison costs, not factoring in the real likelihood of chronic recidivism after 10 years. It also avoided the issue of a trial, which again, the costs in terms of the judicial time. We have a court system as follows. It doesn't take a lot of these cases before you conclude that a properly funded public defender system has the potential for saving hundreds of millions of tax dollars. We have judges in a court system able to, with surgical precision, determine who needs to go to prison for how long. but an underfunded public defense system hands them a dull axe and a blindfold rather than a scalpel. And that's really where we're at, Mr. Chairman. I think Mr. Stewart, the state public defender, put it best if you look on one of those last pages of your handout is, if you think of the criminal justice system like a car company, you just can't say, gee, those people who are in the tire department have a real problem. The whole car company has a real problem. And that's what we're here today to tell you and to hopefully get some resolution for. And with that, I think we're ready to stand for any questions you all might have.
All right, Mr. Carr, I'll lead off with a few questions. According to statute, and I believe it's 611.18, a public defender may represent individuals prior to a court appearance if the individual appears financially unable to obtain counsel, which suggests that a determination has not yet or fully been determined. Can you speak to whether this statute is ever used in practice given your current caseloads that you face?
Mr. Chair.
Yes,
rarely is it ever used. Every once in a while, we will get a contact from a client or a family member that somebody is in custody. They have not yet been charged, and they would ask us to go over there. That happens really rarely. Most recently, I think in the past 2 years I've been in the 4th District, it's happened one time where a client contacted me and asked if I could look into a situation where he was taken into custody in Maple Grove. His fingerprints were taken. His mugshot was taken, but he was never charged, and he asked if we would look into it. So one time in the 80,000 cases I've been responsible for in the last couple of years.
Thank you for that answer. We do have a legislative auditor's report in our committee file. I think it's from 2001, and there's a part of a sentence in there, and I'd ask you to respond to it. And the report says, quote, imprecise wording in Minnesota law and other incentives encourage the appointment of public defenders, unquote. Would you address that comment of the auditor?
Mr. Chairman and members, I think, is it from the 2001 or
yes.
2000? Okay. There also was a chapter in the
2010. Sorry.
Okay, I'm sorry. 2010 report. I think you have heard from the court and from a number of other folks the issue of pro se litigants. And I know that we've talked with the number of you, Representative Lesh, I think we talked with you about the time it takes for pro se litigants and when they are in court. And it is a drag on the system. And so if there is a bias toward appointing public defenders, I think that is kind of the overwhelming issue relative to that. So.
I think the report, I don't know that I want to ask your opinion, but I might. The report, I think, does reference, however, at least half the judges surveyed referenced in the report indicate that they consider the impact to the court in determining whether to appoint a PD. So is there an inclination, do you think, on the part of the court to appoint public defenders, whether or not the statute specifically requires it in a particular case or not?
Mr. Chairman, again, I think there are a lot of factors at play. I think one is the pro se litigants. I think the other one is an issue of, as I've heard, and maybe Mr. Ward can comment on it further, is we have situations where somebody is borderline. Maybe they don't strictly qualify. But we also know that for them to go out to look for a private attorney, then come back 2 or 3 weeks later and either A, they weren't able to find somebody, B, just because of their own mental health issues, or B, they've contacted a couple of lawyers who weren't willing to take their case, and then come back, now all of a sudden that case is 2 or 3 weeks old, the clock is still ticking, and now we've lost that time. I think there is a certain amount of incentive there to appoint public defenders in those cases, yes. Again, it's a balance of, you know, the time and the effort on the court's part and, on, frankly, on public defenders' part versus individual cases that may or may not end up being public defender cases.
Well, Mr. Kyer, the other side of the coin is the law also requires public defenders to inform the court if they become aware of their client's ability to make partial payments or if they could afford private counsel. That auditor's report also indicates that, and I'm quoting here, public defenders rarely inform judges of those circumstances. Is that the case? Do you have an explanation why that is?
Mr. Chair, if I may, first of all, I think this is becoming more of an issue than it actually is applied in the districts themselves. I know it's an issue for the most part in the 4th District and surrounding metro area. If, in fact, a client is appointed to our office and it is clearly, it appears from the application itself that the client should not have been appointed, I guarantee you the lawyers in my office would let us know because they don't like being appointed to cases where the client can afford private counsel, and they bring it to their manager's attention or to their chief's attention. I have, as the chief, on a number of occasions gone to the court and have asked them to re-examine the application as to whether or not this person should have been appointed to a lawyer or not. And the court typically would look at it and have the client either reapply or ask more specific questions regarding the application. It doesn't happen that much because the examples of this are pretty far and few in between compared to the normal course of appointments that we get. The lawyers are very good at screening these issues and bringing the issues to our attention. The other side of that, though, is this. If the client has, let's be honest, if the client's lied, first of all, if there's an application has a bunch of zeros on it, yes, the court should look at it because anybody who's born isn't at a zero. They're at a plus or a negative at that point. But if the client brings to our attention that they lied on their application, ethically, how are we supposed to bring that to the court's attention when they're telling us that they've done something erroneous? Again, I can't even tell you how many times that's happened. I imagine it's really, really rare. If the client lets us know, or through the pre-sentence investigation that they indeed are employed, the court will take note of that and will have the client either apply some funds towards reimbursement, which happens in many counties in this state, or towards a reimbursement to the state public defender system.
Representative Lesch has a question, but before I go to him, and it's on point, you said there's a very small number of cases where you go to the judge.
Yes.
To have a request and reapply or reevaluate. What's your success ratio once you've made the determination that client can pay? What percent of the time do you succeed in getting the judge to back off requiring a PD on that case?
I've been pretty successful, but again, it happens so infrequently, Mr. Chair, that it's pretty obvious to the person who's screening the information that indeed this person does not qualify.
Representative Lesch on point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Ward, you addressed this a little bit to the extent that people fill out their applications for public defender and reporting income in the same way they fill out their tax forms. Obviously, if it's a clear lie on the tax form on the application, that's one thing. But a lot of times, that discovery is made throughout the course of the case. Oftentimes, at the end of the case, where you're right before sentencing, or certain things come out in sentencing through the investigation that this person has a substantial number of assets, and the public defender is asking him or herself, why did I bust my tail on this person so hard when they could have used a private attorney. So in light of that, maybe not just as the chair was stating, but taking away a public defender and making the person go look for private counsel, reimbursement, how often is the reimbursement successfully used? The other question is, Mr. Ward, to what extent are your attorneys trained to actually look and say, you know what, I smell something funny. The person has a lake house, two rental properties, and a Humvee. It's not on the application, but this needs to be looked at. To what extent are your attorneys trained to raise a flag up on that?
Mr. Ward.
Mr. Chair, clearly, Representative Lesch, if there's a lake house and a boat, it's a pretty obvious example. And we don't get a point of those cases. I mean, what we're talking about typically is the person who's making $17 an hour and he doesn't have any children, whether or not he should be appointed to, we should be appointed to those cases on a felony matter and how serious the felony matter is. The typical situation is a $10 an hour person who doesn't have any kids has a gross misdemeanor or a felony property crime. It's that gray area that is difficult. The obvious example, Representative Lesch, that you provided me, I give you my word to this committee that we have gone to the courts and said, look, somebody missed this. And the court has no problem going through and saying this person should not be appointed a public defender. I worked in a system where the public defenders were responsible for screening whether or not we should be taking on these cases, and I think that system was awful. I do believe that the courts do, for the most part, with the volume of cases we're talking about, a tremendous job in sourcing through these applications and as to whether or not they should be appointed a lawyer to represent them on these cases. As far as being trained to do it, you know, I'm telling you that the lawyers don't like the additional work. I mean, nobody's asking for more work with less lawyers. If it becomes an issue, it's brought to their manager's attention, and they're told to bring it to our attention. So we are the individuals who bring it to the court versus the lawyer fighting against their own client on the appointment.
Mr. Chair, that example that I gave you, Mr. Ward, that was my case. In the second district, the guy had a couple rental properties. He was picked up in DWI, and it wasn't toward the end. And the judge took the case. I said, you know, there's got to be some level of reimbursement here. Now, the attorney was a new attorney, the public defender. They didn't really know what to do on it. But I asked this attorney, don't you think you should, you know, take a look at this and maybe ask for reimbursement on this? Get your office some money back because you should be paid for this, not to the person who shouldn't be get a free attorney. The attorney didn't know what to do, so I brought it up with the judge at sentencing. And the judge, formerly public defender, dear person who I think is great, but said, well, we don't have the capacity to do that. We don't have a fund able to do that. I dealt with this before when I was a public defender. It was very frustrating for me. Then I said, well, just hire fine or something then, something where justice is served so that the individual isn't getting a free attorney, to which otherwise entitled defendants would be getting the attorney. But it was just kind of glossed over because of the general attitude that Mr. Kyer was describing. Well, you know what? It's just easier to just get this done, get it through the system, and be done with it. I have a philosophical problem with that. And that's why I asked about the training, because you're absolutely right. I agree. The public defenders I work with saying, hey, hang on a second, we got to triage this somehow. So they don't want to do that. But I think ingrained in the system is a general attitude to say we've got more important things to deal with right now. That's why I asked.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond. I mean, and those are the cases that make the headlines, right? It's that example that becomes a big issue because realistically, of course, that should have never happened. But the reality is the vast majority of the cases, we are dealing with the issue at hand, and that is the appointments that are cases and the work, the triage that needs to go into those cases. The fact of the matter, there is a system in place that if indeed the court finds out that the person has the funds and the wherewithal, there is a reimbursement as part of the statute that they could pay money into. But again, I'm not just speaking for myself. We've had these discussions on numerous occasions. It is not the issue that I think that's being brought out, whether I'm talking to the media or talking to the folks. I know that environment, but I guarantee you that the folks are so overworked in our office that they see these cases, they bring them to our attention because they're sick and tired of having to represent somebody who has more money than the person who's representing them.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, to clarify,
Mr. Kyer.
We do have a public defender reimbursement statute, and it is used quite frequently. Those reimbursements go to our part-time public defenders to help defray their overhead costs. That doesn't come to the board. It isn't provided for additional attorneys. And you all have a copy. I think the committee doesn't. I know you do, and I know Representative Johnson has a copy of that reimbursement report. We send that every year. So,
I have some other questions, but are there any other questions on the reimbursement point? All right, I'm going to ask you just a few more, and then we'll open this up a little further. Referencing the four public defense corporations, you're asking for, I think, granting $1.4 million for the PD corporations, and you're indicating in the absence of these corporations that about 4,000 cases would be public defender cases. Are these public defense corporations required to follow the same income eligibility guidelines in place for you? And if so, what process is in place to make sure that happens?
Mr. Chairman and members, They are. And they are more, the two of them are, three of them I should say, are intake. So they have clients that come into their office, fill out the forms, and then they look at them, whether or not they qualify, and if there are other issues. We have one corporation that is actually in the courtroom, and on the public defender application, they have a checkbox that says, do they want the public defender or do they want the public defense corporation? That corporation right now is in the process of changing over to that separate intake, if you will. But they all do that screening.
So should this committee be looking at ways to expand the use of public defense corporations and take cases away from public defenders?
Right, Mr. Chairman, public defense corporations are really have been, they predate the board. As a matter of fact, some of them go back, a couple of them go back to the late 1960s, early 1970s. And they are community-based programs that I just don't know that you can all of a sudden decide you're going to duplicate or you're going to add to. I mean, they're ones that grew up with funding from a couple of law firms, from some nonprofits, from some county funding, from some federal funding originally. They originally had federal funding. When the federal funding was eliminated back in, I believe it was the early 80s, the state stepped in to make up that difference. So it's not, I don't believe it's something you can replicate. Frankly, we've had a difficult time trying to keep the four going that we have, particularly the one in northern Minnesota.
I believe the law requires a 10% matching fund by the public defense corporation. So for every $9 they get from you, they have to find one somewhere else. Is that correct?
Correct.
Shouldn't that be a different match, like 50-50?
Mr. Chairman, that's what the statute requires. You know, whether it should be more or less, I will tell you that, at least as I remember, that they all exceed that 10%.
Would you suggest we change the statute, require more equal match?
Mr. Chairman, I think that all four of those corporations are having a very difficult time just surviving right now. As you all know, not only from the state side are they getting squeezed, but their money from foundations and from other sources are getting squeezed, just as I know you've heard from other areas that you sit on. Those are the same situations. So I'm not sure that would, requiring them to have additional match, I'm not sure would be probably in their best interest to keep them functioning.
On another issue, the Padilla versus Kentucky case relative to criminal defense of immigrant status, did the court specify how defense attorneys are to comply with the order and or what constitutes accurate advice?
Mr. Chair, no.
Mr. Ward.
They did not. It's a to say it is a quagmire is an understatement. It was an undertaking that we weren't certainly anticipating at all. We've had many, many meetings and numerous CLEs in this area because there was a complete lack of direction. As all of you have probably heard, that immigration was considered a collateral consequence as far as when a resolution of a case, either through plea or through sentencing, occurred. And then the Supreme Court told us last April that it's not a collateral consequence, that it has to be something that is addressed. Not just, you can't just tell the client, hey, go talk to an immigration lawyer and figure out what you need to do. We have been given the wonderful responsibility of understanding that information ourselves, something that we've never done. And clearly we've done a terrible job and we've attempted to do it in the past. So it has been a vast undertaking by every lawyer in all 87 counties on dealing with these issues.
Well, one could say that the if it's a quagmire, it's kind of the same quagmire as Gideon versus Wainwright. I won't say that. Any other questions from the committee? All right. Who's first? Representative Johnson, then Greenhagen, Liebling, and who else? Hillstrom. Johnson. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Smith. Could you tell me if there have been any counties that have not litigated CHIPS or the Child Protection Services because the public defender system couldn't afford to provide an attorney to parents in these cases? Has that occurred in Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Johnson, there was a Supreme Court decision 2 years ago that this was a county responsibility for representing parents in child protection cases. So there was the state Supreme Court has ruled on that.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And have there been any recent appellate cases that have overturned convictions because offenders could not get fast enough trials or other violations that occurred because public defenders are understaffed either here in Minnesota or other states?
Mr. Ward. Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, there was, I believe, I do not remember the name of the case. I think Representative Hillstrom knows the name of the case. unfortunately, yes, that has occurred. You know, again, so it's clear, when I say the vast majority, 99% of the cases we probably do not demand speedy trial on. If we did, there'd be probably a lot worse problem that we're having right now. We don't have the staff to demand speedy trial on. But there have been, and there is a one case, certainly, I believe one out of Ramsey County and one out of Hennepin County now, where that has occurred. And the result was case was continued ad nauseum because they couldn't get to the trial. And so the case was ultimately dismissed.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If the $75 registration fee expires and the federal funding at $600,000 that's noted in the budget, it looks like that's going to expire too. What impact will that have on your funding?
Mr. Kier.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, it's about $2.5 million. So just I think it's actually in your materials. I think it's somewhere around 40 lawyers, 35 lawyers, something like that.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one last comment. I did enjoy reading the concurrence and dissent writings of the Supreme Court justices on that registration fee case that you provided us. And it is clear that they wholeheartedly agree that civil legal services and the public defender system is, even in its current state, dramatically, chronically underfunded. I mean, that seems to be the point from the Supreme Court justices. Do you agree with that?
Mr. Kier.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, yes, we are underfunded, as is civil legal services.
Very good. Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. just to the testifiers, I met with a couple of judges about a month or so ago from my area, and they seem to echo many of your concerns, especially in terms of the public defender and the situation that it's creating, where the shortage of public defenders and the excess of caseload is actually creating additional cost and delays to the system. And as a elected representative, that's concerning to me. You know, we're talking about a constitutionally mandated area. Now, if we were, and I want to emphasize the word if, because you're well aware we're, you know, even with the additional funding that's come in with the last report, we're still, you know, I never saw so many people happy about being $5 billion in debt yesterday. But compared to six, I guess it is a good thing. But if we were to consider additional funding for this particular area, how am I assured as a freshman representative that the money would actually go to the area where it's most needed?
Mr. Kier.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Grunhagen, by statute, there's a list of items that the board has to consider in terms of where we put staffing. The largest one, or the most important one, obviously, is the results of our weighted caseload study. So wherever that would indicate that the most cases are and the districts that are worse off, I guess you put it, that's where they would go.
Okay, thank you. One other question.
Representative Green again.
Just on the reimbursement to the public defenders, has that increased, decreased, or remained the same in the last several years?
Mr. Kier.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunhagen, it's remained remarkably steady. It goes somewhere between $430,000 to about $480,000 a year, somewhere along.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, can I also make a comment on that? The reason it's remained steady, I believe, is that the chiefs have done a very good job of doing the equivalent of brown bag lunches with the judges and explaining to them that
agency is better off that we don't get appointed on those cases and have the client not eligible for a lawyer. You know, in some respects, in the old ways, it was easier. Well, we'll appoint the public defender, but we're going to assess the cost. Well, that money that the part-time lawyers gets is nothing compared to the cost to the agency. So I believe as an agency, we've gotten much better of addressing all of the benches throughout the 87 counties as to why they shouldn't appoint us in the first place, which is probably why it's remained stagnant over the years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first of all, I wanted to kind of go back for a moment to the reimbursement issue and just to say that, you know, obviously, to Representative Lesh, my good friend here, who I agree with on so many things, you know, oftentimes around here we legislate based on the worst case we've seen, or we take our individual one-time experience and try to legislate based on that. And I think in this case it's pretty clear to me from the discussion that this is not where our problem is, this issue about having people who don't qualify get public defenders. And I just want to also say from the point of view of someone who's done a lot of this that this issue about conflict of interest, I don't know if it was really made clear that when you're a lawyer representing somebody, it's not your role to go out and investigate your client to see if they're getting something they shouldn't get. Now, I'm glad to hear that the lawyers who find out something and report it to their supervisor who can then do something about it. But for the individual lawyer whose job it is to represent a person, you know, think about yourself. If you have a lawyer and that lawyer is investigating you to see if you're doing something wrong, you can't really trust that lawyer. So that really presents a conflict for people. The other comment I wanted to make, or the other question I wanted to ask really, is to what degree has the prosecution community tried to adjust and help the public defenders with this terrible problem of being unable to be there when they need to be there? I mean, you know, I know that, you know, thank you for giving me that wonderful word, ecosystem, that really is, and must have been from you that I got the word originally. But that's a really good way to describe, I think, what goes on in our justice system. It's an ecosystem. So I guess I'm wondering if you can say to what degree the prosecution community is trying to adjust, and are there things that the prosecution community, from your point of view, can do to try to ease the burden of having this terrible restriction in budget and in your ability to be there to represent people?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lieben, the prosecutors have been very supportive on funding issues, obviously on policy issues. We're going to have a different view on things. County attorneys, the city attorneys are both on the Chief Justice's Coalition to Preserve the Judiciary, and I know that we've met with a number of you over the last several weeks. So they've been very supportive in that respect. I think Mr. Ward might have more specifics on this. I think they've been very supportive in terms of trying to make the process work better on that trial level. And I think the judges have too. I think, you know, we've been working with the Judicial Council. We've been working with a number of folks, our liaison judges on that Judicial Council, to come up with some better ways of scheduling, to come up with some better ways of handling these cases. And the prosecutors have been right there. They're feeling some of the same burdens that we are. You know, they've got too many cases. Same burdens that we are. You know, they've got too many cases. They've got, you know, they're feeling the pinch in terms of the financial pinch as well. So they've been very supportive.
Representative Lesh, to that point.
Thank you. Representative Liebling, I've been more than happy to the extent I can, train in a lot of the public defenders in Ramsey County courts. When through no fault of their own, the supervising attorneys in mourning in custody arraignments have been there no more than a year. And they're supervising people who have been there a month because of the horrendous rate of turnover. Public defenders end up relying on prosecutors to the extent they can, of course, representing their client, for information. And I would say more than half of the prosecutors I know are more than willing to fully disclose whether or not they got an upcoming issue on a Rasmussen hearing or a docket motion or other kinds of things that the public defender is going to want be wanting to look at, because if you don't tell them, they're going to find out later, and it's just going to bog everything down. You're going to have to go back to square one because they know the judge is going to do it. So thank you for your full confidence in prosecution, Mr. Kyer, and I would concur based on my experience. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom, did you have?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Taking us back to Representative Johnson's comments about the attorney registration fee and the temporary funding, I too read the full opinion more than once, and I specifically read Justice Gilday's dissent. I know that there is a petition pending. Are you actively presenting, or what is the status of that petition at this time?
Mr. Chairman,
Kyer.
Members, that petition was argued December 10th, I believe it was, last year. And so, as you know, those deliberations aren't something that you could just go in and watch, and so we are cautiously optimistic, and we're watchfully waiting.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Kyer, do you want a Miranda warning before you?
They're called ex parte communications.
Right. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do you have a timeline of when there may be a decision?
Mr. Chair, no. There is no. We have no indication of a timeline.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kyer, so have you requested from the legislature the amount that you may or may not get to replace this amount, or does your budget request just assume you're going to be getting this money?
Mr. Kyer.
Mr. Chairman and members, the budget request includes the funding that would be lost if that $75 attorney registration fee is not renewed. So the request does include it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then is that amount ongoing in your request, so not only for this year, but then ongoing?
Mr. Kyer.
Mr. Chairman and members, it is.
Thank you.
Any further questions? At this time, apparently not. Gentlemen, thank you both, Mr. Ward and Mr. Kyer.
Thank you.
For coming today. Our next meeting will be Thursday, March 3rd at 8:15. Until then, there's no further business. Judiciary Policy Finance stands adjourned.